Curious and want to try a DNA test, but concerned about your genetic data being shared? Secret Sequence is an anonymous genetic testing company. You never give your name for any reason, so they don't sell or share your data, unlike many other companies. They offer various tests, including ancestry, nutrition, exercise. I've done a few myself, and it's really interesting to learn about yourself. For $25 off two kits or more, head over to secretsequence.com and use promo code DNA Today. Again, that's DNA Today at secretsequence.com for $25 off two kits or more.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA.
We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health through conversations with leaders in genetics. These are genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. I'm very excited to share with you. I am launching a new series within the show. This will feature crossover episodes with other genetics podcasts. It's been very exciting over the last 7 or so years to have more shows joining the genetic podcast community, and I thought this would be a really cool way to connect our shows and our listeners. In these episodes, hosts of other genetic podcasts will come on my show as a guest, and sometimes I'll also be a guest on their show, so we'll flip roles, which is what we're doing in this episode. So this episode, I'm teaming up with the Genetics Podcast, produced by Sano Genetics. The show is hosted by their CEO, Dr. Patrick Short. He is experienced in genomics research with a focus on large-scale genomic sequencing projects and rare disorders. Previously, he was at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and the University of Cambridge in England. This is one part of our conversation where I am interviewing Dr. Short about Sano Genetics and one of their current studies about the genetics of autism. To hear the other half of our conversation, check out their podcast. Again, the Genetics Podcast. Search for it wherever you listen to this show. On that episode, Dr. Short interviews me about genetic counseling, and we also talk a little bit about cytogenetics, which was my focus in undergrad, and I haven't talked about it too much on air. I have one episode about it a long time ago on this show. But anyway, so in this episode, we are focused on the genetics of autism, which, as many of you know, is a really hot topic, and I've wanted to dive into it on this show for a while. So I hope you enjoy, and as always, email into info@dnapodcast.com with any questions or comments you have about our conversation or others on the show. So thank you so much, Dr. Patrick Short, for coming on the show. I'm excited to have our conversation about Sano Genetics and genetics of autism.
It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
So tell me about your company. What is Sano Genetics? What do you offer consumers and patients?
So we started the company about 3 years ago. Myself and two others, Will Jones and Charlotte Guzzo, we were students, PhD students at the time at the University of Cambridge. And we started the company really for two reasons. The first was probably obvious to any researchers listening. It's really challenging to get data for clinical trials or for other research studies. Because it's hard to motivate people to participate in research studies. But the more important part of the equation was that for participants in research studies, it's really challenging to find the right information. There's a lot of misinformation in genetic testing. It's a lot of fear around what participating in a clinical trial or research study actually is, and also lack of transparency around how your data might be used. So we decided to try to create a solution for this, and quite simply, it's a platform that connects participants on one side who want to support research or enroll in trials in precision medicine or genetics with researchers that are looking for a more patient-centric model for research.
So not only are you helping patients find this research and become participants and partners in this research, you're helping the researchers find people. So it's that two-prong approach.
That's right. The best case scenario, it's a win-win for researchers. They, especially in rare genetic conditions, which was my focus in research for a long time, it's always challenging to find enough people to do studies that are well-powered enough and to recruit for clinical trials when there may be just a couple of hundred people in the whole country. But on the other side, the patients are saying the exact same thing. Our condition is rare. no one's working on it because, you know, because it's rare, there may not be funding. So trying to really match make these two sides and help both sides find each other is our goal.
And social media and the internet has just completely changed the rare disease community to be able to find each other. I've talked with a lot of rare disease patient advocates and people that have started their own organizations, been able to find so many people with that condition and unite together and then approach researchers. And so it's really exciting for the rare disease community to learn about you and see ways that they can connect with you and advance research and be more connected.
Yeah, absolutely. In my PhD, I worked on a big project that enrolled families that had an undiagnosed developmental disorder, and about 25 to 30% of the patients would get a genetic diagnosis as part of the projects. And one of the most amazing thing was after that happened, there may not be a treatment or a cure of any kind, but for the family, it was an incredible end to a diagnostic odyssey. It meant they could join a patient group in many cases. They could join a Facebook group and start speaking with other parents to try to understand how their child might develop differently. So the diagnosis is just the beginning, but with the internet, it's really changed the way we can do this kind of research.
And being able to offer an end to that diagnostic odyssey is huge. It takes people so many years. I think the average is 7 years or something like that to find a diagnosis, with misdiagnoses along the way. And as you said, being able to connect with other people who have that disorder, a very similar disorder, and it's a little bit less of the unknown. There's still a lot of unknown there, but not as much when you're undiagnosed.
Exactly. And we work with quite a few great patient groups, mostly here in the UK, but some in the US as well. So there's a group called the Phelan-McDermid Syndrome Foundation, for example, that's in the US we work with. And if you're not aware of the condition, it's a deletion of part of a chromosome that causes severe autism and intellectual disability. And we're finding that working with these groups is really great because they've built up a huge amount of expertise in the condition, and they have patients that are interacting every day on their Facebook groups or on their website, and they're really eager to help research. And we bring some expertise in genomic data analysis and a platform that we can help connect them to research.
So if people are listening and they say, wow, I really want to get involved, I want to participate in studies that you're involved in, how do they know if they're eligible? Where can they start this journey to figure out if they are eligible to join?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the hard things about being a small and early stage company is that we are not able to do everything that we want to do. So rather than try to do every condition and everything we possibly can, we've decided to focus on where we think we can have the most impact, and that's in rare and chronic genetic conditions. So right now we are running studies in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, condition called ankylosing spondylitis, rare diseases like Phelan-McDermid syndrome and muscular dystrophy, and also more common traits and conditions like autism spectrum disorder, and relatively recently type 2 diabetes. So the thread that connects them all is that they're rare chronic genetic diseases. So anyone can go to the website. It's www.sanogenetics.com. And we list on our website all the research projects we're running. So people can still sign up if they don't qualify. And we have new studies running every month. So we send you can add information about yourself when you sign up to the platform, and you'll get an email if there's a study that does fit for you. But in the early stages, we've decided to actually just focus on, you know, doing a small number, half a dozen or a dozen studies really well, and not try to do everything at once.
That makes sense. Focus on the quality over, you know, a lot of quantity happening.
Exactly.
And you mentioned that one of the focus is autism. And so we're going on the episode today. Before we explore the autism study that you're involved in, it'd be great to hear more about what we know about the genetics of autism, and kind of what we don't know is probably more than what we know. But how much is it that we know about the role that genetics plays in people having autism?
Yeah, autism is a really fascinating and challenging area of research. So as I mentioned before, my PhD research focused on rare and very severe neurodevelopmental disorders. So often the child has intellectual disability, they may have issues with other organ systems like the heart or the immune system. And a large number of neurodevelopmental disorders also have autism as a symptom. So, children have a tendency towards repetitive behaviors or towards socializing differently than what you might call a typical child. And this is, this is one description of autism in the context of neurodevelopmental disorders. But then there's another description, which is on a more population level. So autism can be described, I think, very fairly as a trait. It's not, in my view, it's in many cases not a condition, really. It's a trait, and it's something that's continuous in the population. So you can there are validated metrics for actually measuring exactly where you fall on the autism spectrum, and there's still a huge amount to be learned about how genetics relates to autism. And also, when we say autism, it's an umbrella term that can contain so many different things. So in terms of genetics specifically, there have been quite a few genome-wide association studies run that have found both specific monogenic genes, single genes that contribute a great risk to intellectual disability and autism, and in some cases just autism. But there's also a broad common population component to autism that we're still very far from understanding.
And with so many different types of autism, it makes the research, I would imagine, more difficult because, as you said, it's really autism spectrum disorder. So it's much larger than maybe we thought it was in the past, in the way that we diagnosed that it really is a spectrum of all different types of autism and different aspects that go with that. As you mentioned, it's really a treat. I like the way that you explained that. I think it's a really accurate way and not as clinical as maybe some other people may phrase that. Do we know any specific genes? You did say that there were some of them. Do we have certain ones that are like, wow, these are kind of five that we really focus on? Or is there just so many that people really aren't focused on saying a few of them?
Yeah, so depending on who you ask, there are anywhere between, like you say, five genes to some research papers, we'll say hundreds. The example I mentioned earlier of Phelan-McDermid syndrome, there's a very well-known autism gene, which is called SHANK3. So, I'd say a small number of very well-characterized genes that are often involved in both autism and intellectual disability. But in autism more generally, it's really a complex genetic maybe a cascade is the right word, but we really don't understand exactly how do all these small changes in genetics manifest in differences in synaptic pruning or changes in the brain. And I think part of the challenge here is that defining it, like you said earlier, as a single thing is almost certainly not right. There's different elements to what autism spectrum disorder is. And so we have to get better about describing underlying trait or condition before we can really hope to predict it from genetics or any sort of other measure that we have.
And we're starting to do that with genetic testing. Especially children more, can go in for genetic testing to see if they can be genetically diagnosed with autism. How often when people go into this, do they end up having a genetic diagnosis of autism? Is this something that, sometimes the test ends up giving results that are useful and positive, or is it almost a shot in the dark, like you could end up having something, but probably not?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I could put my number on a specific diagnostic rate. My real background is in neurodevelopmental disorders. And I think in general, about half of cases, end up being picked up by frontline screening. And after that, it becomes like a diagnostic odyssey that we discussed earlier. But even this number is really dependent on the healthcare system that you're in. And it doesn't account for things that we already screen for really early, like Down syndrome, for example. So even getting estimates on something like this that is prevalent, probably 100, one in 100 or one in 200 births have some kind of developmental disorder. It's really hard to know exactly how this all plays out through the healthcare system.
Yeah, there's so many different diagnoses that it could be for a lot of these conditions. Of just developmental delay is such a wide, wide umbrella with so many different types of disorders under that. So it's definitely hard to be able to pinpoint that, especially even if it's autism with under that, a lot of different diagnoses with that.
Aside from the neurodevelopmental disorder case, if it's autism more generally in the population, then I would say there it's almost hopeless to diagnose from a genetic test. If a direct-to-consumer genetic testing company says, you know, we're going to do a genotype array and give you an autism risk score, I know that the state of research is very far from being able to predict autism in that way. But in the neurodevelopmental disorder case, it's a little bit easier to understand the monogenic disorders.
Certainly, those we are a little bit more straightforward than when you have so many different genes playing a role into something when it's multifactorial. So I wanted to learn a little more about the autism research study that you're involved with. You're partnered with University of Cambridge. What are you exploring in this research study?
Yeah, that's right. So we met Dr. Varun Warrior and Professor Simon Baron-Cohen quite a long time ago, two or three years ago, while we were still starting up the company. And we explained to them what we were trying to achieve, connecting people more closely to research. And from the beginning, they understood, I think, what we were trying to do. And they've been supportive over the last couple of years in helping us actually refine what it is that we do and how we engage people in research. So relatively recently, we started working with them to take a test that Professor Baron-Cohen had developed called the Autism Quotient 50 and make it available to people to fill out as a questionnaire online. And if they choose to donate their genetic data to the study, then they can do so. So what the test does basically is allows you answer 50 questions, and they're questions about general everyday life. For example, can you do you easily remember phone numbers, for example, might be one of the questions. And what Simon and Varun are working on is correlating the responses to this autism quotient 50 score with genetic data and doing it in an entirely crowdsourcing and volunteer basis. So sorry, our portion is an entirely crowdsourced and volunteer basis. They are doing lots of other kinds of sequencing through the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium.
So it's exciting that they are collecting these, you know, 50 answers, these questions, but looking at those responses and potential genetic differences in those participants compared to the general population.
Yes, exactly. So this is very much about understanding autism as a trait. It's not the 50 test questionnaire isn't about diagnosis. It's really about thinking of autism as a quantitative trait and something that can vary in the population. And as I mentioned earlier, our understanding of this is very limited, and we need hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people to really pin down the you know, genetic underpinnings of something this complex.
The more data you have, the easier it is to say, oh, we're starting to see that, say, X change is happening more in people with autism than it is the general population of people that don't have autism. And yes, the more data you have, the easier that becomes, but it's still not easy process.
No, it's still very hard.
And so this seems to be a study that has been spun off from other studies that the two researchers have been involved in. Can you speak at all to the studies they've done before, looking at like sex differences and how that's related to autism trait?
So unfortunately, I don't know if I have enough of an understanding of the nuances of their previous work to really go into it in detail. I know Simon has been working in this field for a very long time, and he's developed some of the benchmarks and also quite a few foundational theories around autism itself. But I think it'd probably be best if he went into the weeds and the details on this, because I don't think I would do it justice.
Yeah, no problem. It's definitely a very new area that we're exploring and figuring out new information from it. Do you know if, you know, any of these studies that I've read a little bit about the microbiome and how that might be have you seen any of this or been reading anything related to this? Is this part of your study at all?
Yes, absolutely. So it's not part of the study, but I've been following it really closely. My opinion as a, you know, personally, and as from the science that I understand, is that it's still really early to make any claims about the microbiome influencing autism risk. I think time will tell exactly how these this body of research plays out. It's certainly intriguing, and you know, there's more and more interesting work mounting up to try to link changes in the microbiome to changes in the brain effectively, or changes in the immune system that might then affect the brain. I'm really interested in it from a research perspective. I think this is exactly the kind of thing that you need tens of thousands of volunteers. You need randomized control trials to really understand, you know, is there something going on here? That the challenge I've always found with the microbiome is it can be somewhat circular. Does the microbiome affect the condition, or does the condition affect the microbiome, or is there some third factor that we haven't accounted for?
And with the microbiome, it's very challenging because it's not static like human genetics, where you're looking at, oh, okay, these are the changes in someone, and comparing that, like we've been talking about, to a general population that doesn't have a trait or disorder or symptom. But the microbiome is changing all of the time. It's the bacteria that's living in us and, you know, in symbiosis. So it's hard to be able to really dive into that and find those differences, because we have so many different strains of bacteria in us and how those are interplaying. So the microbiome is very overwhelming to me.
Exactly. I mean, the example I often like to think of is if you suppose that the microbiome is contributing to obesity, then if your diet is different, it will affect your microbiome, which might in turn affect your body's processes or your diet. And it's going to be really difficult to know which one came first. Did the microbiome change and then the eating habits change, or the reverse? So without really careful trials, like you say, the fact that it's changing all the time means it's difficult to know.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's an exciting area to look at, and definitely one that is much newer in research that Human Genome Project was almost 2 decades ago at this point, but the microbiome is one that's really up and coming, and we'll kind of see where we're headed with that and everything that we're learning there.
That's right.
Before we close out the show, is there anything else that you wanted to leave or off with, or any people can get more involved?
So as I mentioned before, we're a small and early stage company. So we're trying to make as big of an impact as we can in a couple of small areas, but we always love to hear from any researchers that are interested in running more patient-centric trials, whether it's in rare chronic genetic conditions, and also patient groups. So one of the most important and underutilized resources in particularly in rare disease research is the incredible patient groups that are often started by a parent of a child or someone who suffers from the condition themselves. And there's an incredible expertise from the patient and within the patient group that I think is often missed, because when you have a disease that's, you know, one in 100,000, then it's almost certain that you will know more about that disease than your doctor, unless you're visiting the world's greatest specialist. So I think both researchers have a lot to learn from patients, as well as the reverse.
And that's a great perspective to have, like coming from the research side. I think when patient advocates come on the show, I'm always just so impressed with how much they know and how much research they're doing, that, as you said, oftentimes, unless they're seeing that world expert on that condition, they are the expert on the condition. So it's great that you're able to really value that and take that into account. And, you know, they're really partners in research, and being able to see that how many people they've pulled together for a condition like we talked about. So yeah, it sounds like anyone listening, if you have your own patient advocacy group or you're starting one, sounds like they should shoot you an email and see if there's a way that you guys can partner up.
Yeah, please do. We'd love to hear from anyone. There, as a perfect story or an example of this, we interviewed a guy here in Cambridge named Nick Sereau on our podcast, and they recently, so his sons are affected by a rare disorder, and they put together a amazing clinician, a pharmaceutical company, a academic research group, a patient group, and together over the past decade, they've gotten a molecule through clinical trials to treat the rare disorder. And they've all said that without any one piece of that puzzle, it wouldn't have been possible to do. So I think there's some amazing and inspiring stories out there that are often spearheaded by a patient or a patient group themselves that just work hard to get the whole thing moving.
Yeah, very inspirational. And there's so many groups out there like that. I'll have to go back and listen to that episode of your show. And I think listeners should as well.
Yeah, it's a great one. I get goosebumps every time I hear him talk about it.
Well, thank you again so much for coming on the show and exploring genetics of autism and what we know, what we are hoping to learn in the future. And, you know, hearing about Sano Genetics, and excited to, you know, keep tuning into your show. I appreciate you coming on.
Great. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the podcast. It's really great stuff you're doing and looking forward to hearing it.
Learn more about Sano Genetics at sanogenetics.com and follow them on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all at Sano Genetics. Be sure to hear the other half of our conversation on their show, The Genetics Podcast. Again, Dr. Shore interviews me about genetic counseling, genetic testing, and we dive into cytogenetics a little bit. I also wanted to mention I've been on a few other podcasts recently. I was a guest on In Eyesight with Jeff Maxim. Over three episodes, we had interesting conversations. My favorite was the impact social media has had on the rare disease community. I was also on Your Golden Years with Dr. Mara Karpel. We talked about genetic counseling, testing, and common questions that people have on those topics. I'm booking a few other podcasts, so once those are released, I'll be sharing that on my social media, on Twitter at DNA Podcast and on Instagram at DNA Radio. Recently on Instagram, I reshared the episode I recorded with a few classmates discussing the first year of genetic counseling grad school. If you're starting school in the next few weeks or just curious about it, considering applying, go back and listen to episode 101 for the GC Grad School 101. All of this information is available on the website dnapodcast.com. Any questions you have, again, info@dnapodcast.com. And one more announcement. A few weeks ago, I asked you listeners to help nominate DNA Today for the Podcast Awards. I am very happy to share with you that the show has been nominated in the Science and Medicine category. Winners will be announced at the end of September 2019. Thank you. It means a lot to have you take the time and nominate me. I hope you guys really like the show and you get a lot out of it. Always great to hear from you and hear your insight and what you would like for me to talk about on the show. I wanted to remind you about Secret Sequence's exclusive offer to you as a DNA Today listener. If your genetic privacy is important to you, but you still want to do a DNA kit, head over to secretsequence.com and use code DNA Today at checkout for $25 off two kits or more. I've done a bunch of the kits myself, ancestry, exercise, nutrition, and skincare. If you want to hear about my experience using those, listen back to episode 105 with the founders. I share some of my results on there, parts of which were new information for me, like being at a higher risk for joint injuries and fractures, something to keep in mind with my workouts. Also, that a Mediterranean diet isn't likely to be as effective as a low-fat carb diet for me to maintain a healthy weight. Other results confirmed what I've already experienced in life, such as liking the bitter taste of coffee. I actually drink it pretty much black, only a little sugar, while being really sensitive to its caffeine, and having sensitive skin and bad acne, not the best genes I've inherited. Check it out for yourself using promo code DNATODAY at secretsequence.com. So thanks for listening, and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.